Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11. Tower cleared.
Here, we got a roll program.
Neil Armstrong reporting the roll and pitch program, which puts Apollo 11 on a proper heading.
Hi, I'm Rachel Ann Goodman, and this is Talk of the Bay on KSQD 90.7 FM. And today marks almost the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11's mission to the moon. And we're very excited today to have in our studios Mike Irby. He serves as senior director in the special products group for Poly, which was formerly Plantronics, where he focuses on products built to order in Santa Cruz for clients across government, military, and aerospace. And he plays an integral role in the development of products for unique use cases and mission-critical environments. And, of course, he's a passionate audiophile himself, so we'll be able to talk about that in a radio studio. But I think we'll probably focus mostly in this interview on the role Plantronics had in landing on the moon. I know where I was. I know what age I was, and you probably do, too, if you were around my age. In school, we all got herded into the auditorium, and we all watched a little teeny black-and-white television and watched the astronauts as they stepped down the ladder and onto the moon. And I just remember thinking it was fantastic and exciting because the adults were making a big deal out of it, and it was also a big deal to me. So Plantronics has an interesting connection to that story, and I think we'll start before the actual moon landing and back up. Mike, if you could kind of walk us through how Plantronics did get connected with NASA back in the early space program as they were considering a trip to the moon that was human-led.
I'd love to, and thank you, Rachel. It's great to be here. The story of Plantronics is awesome in that the company was founded on May 18th, 1961. And what I find fascinating about the story is that exactly a week later is when President John F. Kennedy stated that we should make it the national mission to go to the moon. So those two things coinciding together just, you know, almost bring tears to my eyes. And the company was founded by two pilots, and one was a commercial airline pilot, and the other one was the private pilot and a flight enthusiast. And the commercial pilot, his name was Courtney Graham, and he was a natural salesperson. And the other gentleman, Keith Larkin, was a tinkerer. And so these two gentlemen had the idea that the typical heavyweight headsets that were used then by airline pilots, not unlike what we are wearing now, by the way, were quite uncomfortable. And there should be something better, especially for pilots that were spending many hours in the air. So they had already had the idea of using these miniature hearing aid transducers, and their ideas spanned everything from embedding them in the bows of sunglasses to what else could they do with these things and make a better communication device. So in 1961, they had already experimented with a lightweight headset that used these hearing aid transducers for both microphones and speakers, and had submitted that design to the FAA for approval so that it could be used by pilots. So let's fast forward a little bit to 1962, where we had NASA over here launching the Mercury spacecrafts quite frequently, and you had Plantronics in Santa Cruz building these headsets for use by pilots and trying to get off the ground. And I think it was the second Mercury mission where Gus Grissom landed in the ocean and the hatch on his spacecraft blew off prematurely, and the spacecraft began to fill with water and sink. And there are pictures of the rescue helicopter being pulled down into the ocean. Gus Grissom escaped, but he almost drowned, and the rescue helicopter had to let the capsule go. So from that, NASA said, gosh, we need some kind of backup communication system for these astronauts, because naturally when the water poured into the capsule, everything short-circuited, and nothing worked, including the radios. So there was no way that astronaut Grissom could talk to the rescue teams. So NASA contracted with a company that built this very small radio, had a short talk time duration, fit into the pocket of a spacesuit. They wanted a very lightweight headset that would plug into it that could be used as a backup to what the astronauts were then using, which was a heavyweight headset. And somebody someplace saw the Plantronics headset that we had presented to the FAA and decided, gosh, that would be the perfect thing for use on this emergency backup radio. So one of the very first Plantronics employees, a gentleman by the name of Steve Spragans, had some connections, professional connections, and was alerted to the fact that this headset was being looked at by NASA. And kind of the rest is history. He ended up flying down to Houston, meeting with astronaut Schirra. Astronaut Schirra posed the million-dollar question, gosh, you guys, NASA engineers, are making me wear this big, heavy headset underneath my helmet, and the space flights are getting longer and longer and longer, and we're looking at many days in space. Why can't we take something like this Plantronics headset and tweak it so that it fits underneath my helmet? And the story goes that he challenged the NASA engineering people to do that. They communed to Mr. Spragans at Plantronics that was the mission. Steve got on a plane, flew back here, and in 11 days we had some prototypes made to the NASA specs that would fit into the communications carrier, also known as the Snoopy caps, that the astronauts wore into their helmets.
That's really fast, 11 days.
It's
a very short amount of time. So if you're listening to KSQD right now on a tiny little headset, perhaps, or something micro that sticks in your ears, you might want to thank the engineers at Plantronics for helping you get to this. You probably don't appreciate the evolution of headsets and how they've shrunk and how important it was to the astronauts. So how did they do that in 11 days? I mean, how do you do anything that fast? Were they just round the clock, 24/7?
You know, I've had a number of discussions with Steve Spragans, and that's what he said. They jumped on a plane, flew back here, and they had a model shop at the Plantronics facility, which was located not adjacent to where we are now. But yeah, they just worked literally 24/7 and machined these little aluminum enclosures and stuffed in the little miniature microphones and receivers that they needed.
And the people that were working at Plantronics back then, what kind of training did they have? Where were they coming out of? Engineering schools, or were they coming out of aerospace, or what?
Well, it was a pretty small team of people at the time, and like I said, Courtney Graham, one of the founders of the company, was an airline pilot, and he was personal friends with Keith Larkin, who was a tinkerer, who had a little company that was making things for airplanes. I think the name of the company was called Plane Aids. And so he was just tinkering with things and trying to sell them. And they had a brilliant acoustics engineer that was also a friend that they hired. And then they hired Steve Spragans, who at the time worked at Sylvania, that was right down the street from where the studio.
You know, we've lost a lot of our manufacturing base here in Santa Cruz, but Plantronics is one of the holdovers from the era where there was a lot of industry in Santa Cruz, including a tannery right across the street here, and, a Wrigley gum factory. So it really is interesting that the history of the space program and Plantronics sort of intersected to keep pushing it well into the 21st century. So we can talk about where it is now in a little while, but I do want to keep following this really interesting story of how, you know, Apollo 11 eventually happened and what got said and how. So there were a number of other space flights between the one you were talking about where he almost drowned, Gus Grissom, to, you know, Neil Armstrong and what we know we're celebrating 50 years of. What are some of the intermediary steps that happened?
So great question. And as you may know, there were three space programs. There were the Mercury program, and there were a number of missions in that, I think 8 or 10 missions in the Mercury. And that was really the beginning of the space program. And those were small capsules, typically suborbital or just a couple of times around the Earth, very short duration. And there was one astronaut in the spacecraft. That was followed by the Gemini program, which were longer space flights, multiple orbits around the Earth, and two people in the spacecraft, two astronauts. And then lastly, there were the Apollo programs. And the Apollo program, Gemini 2, were really a direct result of President Kennedy's announcement to go to the moon. And NASA engineers knew early on that that was going to be a three-person endeavor, one person in the command module circling the moon, and two people in a lunar module that would actually land on the moon for some period of time. And they had millions of things to figure out. But the essence of the three space programs were stepping stones to develop the technology to get three people to the moon and back.
I read somewhere that it took 400,000 engineers and a really large number of dollars. I need to find that because it was pretty shocking. It was $24 billion at the end, which is really jaw-dropping. In today's dollars, that's $100 billion.
$100 billion.
Yeah. So just think about the Apollo program costing that much. 400,000 engineers, technicians, and scientists. I can't think of another effort, you know, that has since happened in this country that A, cost that much, and B, galvanized the imagination. I would like to think that the next revolution is going to be a green one where we transition completely off of fossil fuels and spend that kind of money. It's that urgent, but that's another story we'll hopefully be telling to our grandkids. But yeah, lots of effort, lots of people. And we are celebrating the 50th anniversary. It's hard to believe it's been that long, right? Mm-hmm. 50 years goes by rather quickly and recedes into the past so quickly that it's a good opportunity to kind of remind people all of the effort and reasons behind such a big effort. So in the couple Apollo missions before 11, can you talk about some of the learned lessons that maybe happened in communications as well as in some of the other technologies?
Well, the Apollo program was, like I said, really a series of dress rehearsals. I think there were 11 missions in total, and we went to the moon a total of six times. Apollo 11 was the first time. But prior to Apollo 11, I think there were two missions that actually circled the moon, and so they were dress rehearsals for getting Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins and Neil Armstrong to the moon and back. So the lessons were being learned all along the way. And like you said, the fact that there were so many people working on this, it's stunning when you think that the Earth is spinning at over 1,000 miles an hour and we're moving through space at 66,000 plus miles an hour. So, you know, it's not like the Earth was a target and these guys were at the moon aiming at a target. The target was both spinning and moving. And, you know, these engineers, among many other things, had to figure out how they were going to plop down in the Pacific Ocean at about the right spot without burning up. And, you know, and then there was, you know, time lags with communications. I think radio communications take a second and a quarter or so to get back and forth. So nothing was instant. And all that had to be figured out and was unknown. And some of it we could test and some of it we couldn't.
It's the couldn't part that takes a lot of bravery, you know, and faith in the people you hire to be very much figuring it out as they go. And it's amazing what, you know, the astronauts were doing, trying to pinch hit in a situation where they'd never been before.
Mm-hmm.
Takes a lot. You know, that's why they're heroes. It's not just because of what they knew. It's because of what they didn't know and could figure out on the run.
Yes. And we know that from Apollo 13, for example, where, you know, they had a malfunction in one of the tanks that, you know, blew out in space. And, you know, many of us saw the movie or read books about that. And there you have it. You know, it's like we have a problem. And
Houston.
Yeah.
Those were the famous words. I was going to, you know, remind people of some of the famous words that were said over the Plantronics headset as these things were unfolding. You know, Houston, we have a problem, was the most famous, second most famous thing. The Eagle has landed.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
You know, when they actually did land on the moon, and took them 240,000 miles and 76 hours to get there. And they landed at 1:46 p.m., manned by Armstrong and Aldrin, separated from the command module, and Collins had to stay behind. I wonder how they decided that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have wanted to be him.
Or who was first out of the lunar module.
Right.
Yeah. Did they draw go ahead, Neil.
Because he has an A in his last name. Yeah.
You go for it.
A for Apollo. You get to go first.
Yeah, a number of years ago, Rachel, I attended a symposium at NASA at Kennedy Space Center, and it was talking about things the astronauts didn't know. One of the things that they immediately found out was that the dust, and Neil Armstrong talked about this in some of his first narrative from walking on the moon, was that this dust was so fine it just impregnated everything. And when they walked out of the lunar module, they had to leave the door open, of course, for some period of time, and this dust was just everywhere. And so it was on their spacesuits, and the dust was grinding away at some of the gaskets on the everything from the door frames to you name it, some of the mechanical parts. And so these were things that they had no idea were going to happen and had to figure out and you know, try and mitigate for future missions, and including the Skylab, which happened in the early 70s. So
it's hard to imagine what we didn't know about the moon. But if you go back, you know, to the 1900s, some people thought it was made of green cheese. I really didn't have any clue what was there.
Well, cows jumped over it, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it was flat. You couldn't see the other side ever. But they did go around the backside and realize there was another side to it and took some great pictures. So the second most famous, you know, conversation was that statement that they made when they actually walked there. Do you want to recall what that was?
Oh, the this is one small step.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to step off the land now. It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Yep. And, you know, it's interesting. There's Neil Armstrong states that he said this is, that he used the word A. I don't know if that came through on the radio, you know, that transmission. But, yeah, one small step for a man, one giant leap. So those words were spoken over a Plantronics headset.
How did they transmit from the moon to the Earth? I mean, this we're in a studio. There's a lot of chains in the broadcast chain in order to get to people's ears. You know, the headset's just one. The microphone's just one. There's a transmitter involved. How is that just a regular radio transmitter they use? Do you know how they got the signal from there to the Earth?
Yes. So the words were spoken into a Plantronics headset, which was the interface device for the astronauts, and there was a radio in their backpack systems, and then that radio relayed to the lunar module or the command module, which in turn relayed back to Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and was it just RF, regular radio signal?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's not much interference out there. The atmosphere is quite non-existent, right? So there's nothing in its way.
Well, there's nothing in its way. You're right. However, with radiation and those sorts of things, and, you know, they had to be very aware of, you know, the fact that they needed to be line of sight, because these sorts of communications are more line of sight, and as you know, on the dark side of the moon, there's no radio communication, and so that was something else that they had to remain aware of and cognizant of.
When they were testing the headsets and the radio communications on Earth, how did they simulate the conditions up there, and could they?
I don't really think they could. They just assumed that UHF communications were going to work fine.
Huh. A lot of there was a lot of hope and prayer going on, and wishful, hopefully this will work out. If you just joined us, I'm speaking with Mike Irby. He is an engineer with Plantronics who has been there for 38 years, not quite as long as the 50-year anniversary of Apollo 11 that we're celebrating come July 19th, but definitely long enough to know the history of the organization and its connection to NASA. You know, NASA wasn't that well known. Neither was Plantronics back then. I mean, both were pretty small compared to what notoriety NASA got from the moon landing and thereafter.
Very, very true. Back in those days, I think the early days of Plantronics, there were half a dozen people. And like I said, they were all friends and down the street here in Santa Cruz making some headsets. And really, the relationship with NASA was a springboard along with the approval of that first FAA headset that I mentioned earlier. That happened in June of 1962, where the FAA granted airworthiness certification to the design that the Plantronics people had submitted for use by pilots. So a combination of those two things really was a springboard for the company. And very, very soon there were a number of employees, and they moved to bigger facilities and started producing other models of products.
And the air traffic controllers used them, or maybe still use them. That's correct. So their hands could be free doing whatever else they do.
So that's a great segue. To this day, and for the last almost two decades, we have been the preferred provider to the FAA for air traffic control. So yes, every time you get on an airplane, and you know, I'm kind of a geek like this, but I love listening to the cockpit channel, and I know that the controllers are talking on products that were tested right here in Santa Cruz and built right across the street from the studio.
And you don't think of headsets as, you know, being a lifeline for the passengers and the crew, but if you think about it, if you lost your communication or your headset went out, we would have trouble in radio land too, knowing what we were doing, but there's not quite as much at stake as running an airplane or a space shuttle or, you know, the Apollo 11. So you don't think about that piece in the chain as being so incredibly important until you think about what would happen if it went out, mm-hmm. which would be bad.
And examples of that are, this was a number of years ago, but I was on a flight, took off out of Denver International Airport on a summer afternoon where there's frequently thunder showers, and we had just rotated off the runway. It was a United Airlines flight, and I was listening to the cockpit channel, and I heard the controller say, United Airlines flight 123, whatever the flight number was, wind shear activity deviate right. And the controller said it that calmly, and in an instant that airplane was on its wing. And wind shear, you know, is a potentially devastating wind activity that if you fly into, you can result in a crash. And, you know, there were the passengers, many of them gasp in surprise. But, there was a part of me that was smiling and proud of the fact that these communications were happening over our headsets. And this is the kind of thing that happens all the time. And we like you said, Rachel, we just don't think much about it.
Yeah, we take for granted so much of technology, and then we realize how much thought has gone into creating it. We feel a little bit better that, you know, they've worked out some of the bugs. Always there's human error, and there's technology does fail, but knowing that the engineers have really thought through all the possibilities makes us feel a little better taking to the skies, and in the case of the astronauts, taking to space, which is an even more dicey proposition because, you know, you can't just bail out in a parachute up there. It's a whole different deal. So.
And with regard back to the early days of NASA, the technology bugs, the basically what NASA asked us to do was build in redundancy. So, okay, let's just not put one microphone on the headset. Let's put two. And let's not put one little speaker. Let's put four or five or six. So if one breaks, then the headset would continue to work. So you're right. That was the way they tried to mitigate the unknowns with regard to technology and using the technology in unknown environments.
So we're coming up on this anniversary. Do the folks at Plantronics plan some sort of celebration for the anniversary?
I'll leave that up to...
I think they're There will be a little bit.
It's going to be cake.
Yeah. Okay. Let's have cake.
50 candles, something.
50 yeah. candles. Yeah. So one of the things we're doing is there's a segment that we're filming with our CEO, Joe Burton, wonderful and inspirational man, by the way. And that'll be put on the company intranet site so that our associates all over the world will be able to view it. And it'll be a segment not unlike this, where we'll be talking about and actually showing some mock-ups and some of the products that we have from back in the day. So the answer is yes, and it's pretty exciting.
You do have a little museum-ish thing over at Plantronics. I've seen it in the glass case. You have some of the original headsets that from that era.
Can someone
make an appointment to come see them if they want? Yeah. they'll talk to Shannon. That's great to know. So in closing, there are some changes over at Plantronics. You guys have merged with another company. You're maybe changing your name. Does that mean any big change? Are you going to still make headsets? What's happening? You want to give us a brief kind of synopsis of where everything is now and how many people work there around the world?
So this is pretty exciting. A little over a year ago, Plantronics merged with a company called Polycom, and they make video and speakerphone systems. And the idea is we make headsets, and Polycom made speakerphones and video systems. And gosh, the synergy between those two sets of products in terms of being endpoints used by enterprise professionals is just undeniable. And one thing led to another, and we decided to change the name to Poly, which, as you know, is many, and the team word is power of many, which just fits with a lot of things that have done in the past, are doing now, and plan to do in the future.
Well, that's perfect, because our logo is many voices, one station. So you're in the right place. We're Poly, too.
Poly
voices. We're very happy. Well, I'm so glad you could come in and share this exciting anniversary with us and from your perspective at Plantronics. And congratulations to your whole team and all the people who came before you who were part of the Apollo 11 mission. It's really exciting to see the angle from Santa Cruz talked about in this interview.
Thank you very much.
That was Mike Irbe from Plantronics speaking about the role of that company in the Apollo 11 mission. And if it were 50 years ago, the mission would be right between the Earth and the Moon right today as we air that interview. We'll be coming up on another anniversary, the 95th anniversary of the Giant Dipper, and we'll hear about that in just a moment. But first, let's thank a few folks for keeping K-Squid on the air. I'm Rachel Ann Goodman. Thanks for listening to Talk of the Bay, and stay tuned for more.
KSQD thanks Altera Solar for supporting this program. Altera Solar, installing home and commercial solar electricity in the Monterey Bay area for the past 15 years. For information about solar for your home, installing Tesla Powerwall, and expiring federal tax credits, visit www.alterasolar.com/KSQD or 831-425-2608. Thanks, Altera Solar, for supporting KSQD 90.7 FM.
K-Squid is community radio. Do you own a business? You can become a pioneer K-Squid sponsor. Listeners in Santa Cruz and Monterey counties will know you support local community radio, KSQD 90.7 FM, and will support your business. Write to info@ksqd.org. That's info@ksqd.org.